From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Richard Schickel is my guest this week, a film historian, critic, filmmaker, film lover. Richard Schickel has written for Time and Life magazine and many other publications, and he's the author of something like 5,000 books, including the classic The Disney Version, biographies of Clint Eastwood and Elia Kazan. His latest, written with George Perry, is Bette Davis, Larger Than Life, and he has a new book on Clint Eastwood coming out very soon. Richard Schickel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, nice to be here.
Well, before we talk about Bette Davis and Clint Eastwood, I want to ask you, how did you go from a movie watcher to film historian?
Well, that wasn't so hard. Probably the harder transition was back in the early 70s when I was writing books and Disney version and, you know, working on my biography of D.W. Griffith. I made a transition into producing television programs. I started by writing some, and then pretty soon I was producing them. And I guess I've produced, written and directed about as many television documentaries as I have written books. I mean, it's 30-plus in each category, I guess.
What were your first films that you made?
Well, the first series I did that I wrote and directed and produced was called The Man Who Made the Movies, and it was a show of 8-part series on PBS, and it was profiles of 8, you know, kind of great directors of the time, older men, but most of them still working, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock, Frank Capra, men of that stature. And
a lot of those wonderful films have shown up as bonus materials on DVDs.
Yeah, and they played, I revised them. I mean, I just didn't change them a lot, but I sort of smartened them up a little bit a few years ago. And they play on and off on Turner Classic Movies.
Well, since you mentioned that, let me ask you, do you... So you can take your films and you can tweak them the way film directors do these days.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What about your writing? Do you ever wish that some of the words that are out there you could redo?
Yeah, sure. Of course. books are harder to redo in a funny way because, you know, they're set in type. They're set in stone. And, you know, publishers are often enough happy to reprint them, but they're not so happy for you to go through them and start changing things, and then they have to reset type, and then it gets expensive, and then they get cranky. So I say it's, in a way, easier to do a film. You know, you have the elements, and they're fairly easily rearranged. You know, I mean, for example, on the revisions on the Men Who Made the Movie series, you know, I wrote fresh narration. I felt that, you know, those would come out about 1976, so, 20, 25 years had gone by, and maybe 30 years, come think of it. And, you know, I just thought I knew more, that I'd thought more about those directors, and I just felt kind of like, you know, imparting a little newer, fresher information, you know?
Well, let me ask you briefly about The Disney Version, which is a book
Think
came out in maybe 68.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was the first book, I think, that was, you know, critical of Disney.
Yeah, it wasn't all that critical. I mean, the thing about the, you know, Disney, it wasn't quite the empire it's become, but, you know, they had kind of controlled Walt Disney's image and likeness and all that, and they had presented him as this sort of avuncular Middle Western cornball, you know, and that was sufficient unto their purposes. And all I said was, well, he was a little more complicated than that and a little more interesting than that, honestly. And I said some things that, you know, because I talked to people at the studio and worked with them, and, you know, a portrait emerged of, you know, a sort of a darker soul and a more driven soul than the company had liked to talk about. So, you know, they got themselves all in an uproar about it.
Yeah.
In particular, one of his daughters just got outraged by it, and, you know, I actually ran into her a couple of years ago at an event.
Does she still hold a grudge?
Oh, yeah, she stomped away from me. And it's funny, you know, because I brought the book out in a new edition, yeah, I forget, a few years back, and mm-hmm. I reread it, and I wrote a new introduction to it. And in rereading it, I was quite pleased with the book in the sense that I didn't think it was a vicious assault on Walt Disney. I thought it gave him credit for what he deserved credit for and kind of mentioned some things that represented his darker side. And I thought it was a pretty decent, I still liked the book. You know, that's not always true of your older books, but I still liked it. I thought it was a good, honorable, objective report on that man. So, you know, I don't really buy into this outrage.
You stand by the Disney version.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to stand by everything you do, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, always with this caveat, you know, it's the best you could do at that time. The years go by, you learn more about a figure, you know, your opinion of him or his work changes. And then it becomes, after a number of years pass, it becomes, I think, fair to think about revising it. You know, not in gigantic ways, but in nuanced ways. So I wish that books could more easily have that kind of life, where, you know, you sort of stay involved with the figure in your mind and tweak it, you know, not fully revise it, but tweak at it, add new information that's come to light, or change your opinion, or what have you, you know.
Well, now, how do you feel about, we're talking, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Richard Schickel, one of the great film critics and historians and filmmakers. How do you feel about directors tweaking their own work, you know, George Lucas endlessly tinkering? And
it's okay with me.
Doesn't bother.
I mean, I think everybody's entitled to regard everything they do as essentially unfinished. You know, I mean, you know, it's a, you know, people say it all the time about movies. You know, you don't finish them, you abandon them. You know, there comes a moment you just
it's release date.
It's time. The release date is here, and it just has to be turned over to the public, and that doesn't mean you're finished with it necessarily. So I think it's fine. That doesn't necessarily mean that, objectively speaking, you will improve the work. You may not. You may actually, you know, do it some harm. But that's part of your involvement with your own work. I mean, you never really give up on it, do you? I mean, you know. I think it's a little different, maybe. I don't know, it isn't. I was thinking maybe fiction's a little different. You have to arbitrarily say, that's it, I don't want to change it anymore. But, you know, if that were all more feasible in a sort of economic way, I think it's okay to do that.
Well, what about after a filmmaker has left the planet, like, say, Orson Welles, and then they take
yeah.
Touch of Evil and
yeah.
come up with a new version of it? What do you think of that?
That whole Touch of Evil question, I haven't thought about it until you raised it for some time. I don't know about that. I mean, I think, I guess, as I recall it, and I'm not sure I recall it with full accuracy, I guess there was a script, and the finished film didn't quite match the script. But that's often the case with movies, you know. I mean,
sure.
A script is finished, and you know, the director adds or subtracts from it as he's shooting on the picture. hence the auteur theory, you know. So I don't know if the guy isn't on the planet anymore and people go fooling around with it and saying, no, this is what he would have wanted. Well, it's hard to say that. I mean, with full faith and credit in what you've just said. I don't know. It's an ambiguous question. I agree with you on that.
Well, I have another question about the movies and movie stars and so on. Your new book, you have a book on Clint Cumming, and then you have this book that just came out on Bette Davis.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful picture book. It's got some lovely pictures.
I just wrote a little essay. I mean, I always liked Bette Davis, and I'd written about her before, you know.
And then did you eventually know her and get to know her?
Well, not in any huge sense, but I think I recount in this book. I had interviewed her for one of those very early PBS shows I did. It was a show about Hollywood, I think, in the 1940s. It could have been one on the 1930s. Anyway, I did interview her, and she was a very good interview, as you can imagine. She was, you know, a very bright woman, a very assertive woman, and, you know, a terrific interview. I had also met her. I guess the first movie director I ever knew was a man named Robert Rawson, whose most famous film was All the King's Men. And his daughter and my then wife were friends, and we were up at his country house in Connecticut. And guess what? Bette Davis, and he had written at least one picture for her, and you know, they'd known each other on the Warner's lot, was staying up the road. She came walking down, and we all sat around and had drinks, and she was very charming and very nice and very energetic. And then, not long before she died, just a few months before she died, she received one of the Kennedy Center honors. They asked me to write a little essay about her in the program, which I did. And she apparently caught up with that some months after the event. And one day my phone rang, and some voice said, Miss Davis is calling. I said, wonder, who's Miss Davis? Then her voice came on the phone. And, you know, it was Miss Davis indeed. And she said, do we know each other? And I said, well, we've met a couple of times. But no, we don't really know each other. Because she said, it was a very good piece about me. It's as if you were inside my skin or inside my head or something like that. I said, well, that's very flattering. And I'm glad you liked it and all that stuff. And we chatted a moment. And she sort of... She said, we ought to have a date. I said, well, I'd love that. I mean, anytime you're ready, just give me a call. And, you know, she died, I don't know, 2 or 3 months after that phone call. But it was a nice phone call. And, you know, it's funny, little Middle Western boys, and when she was at the peak of her career, I was probably somewhere between the ages of 10 and 15 years old, and... I liked her, you know. You're not supposed to like, little boys aren't supposed to like, movies really aimed at the female audience. But there was something about her, you know, she was so assertive, and in a certain sense, she had masculine virtues, you know, sort of take charge of your life and accept the consequences if it went badly and so forth. So I sort of, I just looked forward to her movies. I thought they were, you know, some of them were quite good. You know, I don't know, Dark Victory, Mr. Skeffington, The Little Foxes, The Letter. I mean, I just thought they were good movies. I enjoyed them, and I enjoyed them when I re-encountered them as an older person. And so I always had a good feeling about her, which wouldn't, let's say, have been true of, say, Joan Crawford, who could be very good at things like Mildred Pierce, but I didn't have the same feelings for her that I had for Davis.
Of course, they had a famous rivalry, didn't they?
Yeah, famous. They really didn't like each other. And you can understand that. You know, these are two ladies who are used to being queens of the lot, and, you know, it was ego, and it was... treatment, you know, is her dressing room bigger than my dressing room, that kind of thing, you know. You know, they were pretty good together. I mean,
weren't they? They were, yeah. Kind of an exciting movie. Well, we're speaking with Richard Schickel, and he's a film critic and biographer and filmmaker, and he's written a new book about Clint Eastwood. Now, you collaborated with Clint Eastwood. Was that, would you call that an authorized?
Well, I didn't collaborate with him. He agreed to be interviewed for the book. That was the biography I did of him. It was back in
10 years ago or so.
I guess it was about 10 years ago. Yeah, but I've known Clint since 1976, and I mean, I don't make any bones about it. We're friends, you know. I mean, we go to dinner together, we hang out together. We've done this is the film that kind of is going along with this book. This is the third film I've done on him. I did a film about the making of Unforgiven. Back, that was, I guess, 92 when that came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequently I did a kind of portrait of him for Turner Classic Movies. I think that was, I can't remember, late 90s, early 1000s. And then this new film, which I think is the best of the three, although I kind of like the one I did on Unforgiven. That was,
what's this film called?
It's called The Eastwood Factor. It's not my title. I don't think it's a great title, but that's what the studio came up with.
Is it hard to be objective about a subject when you know them and hang out?
Yeah, I don't even try. I mean, what's the point, you know? Manifestly, I like the guy. He likes me. We get along. I have no objectivity about Clint's films, you know, I mean, because generally speaking, I know a lot about what's going into him. I almost always read the scripts of his movies before he makes them. Give him a couple of comments if that seems useful.
Does he pay attention to your comments?
He has.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes he hasn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's a kind of a pretty easy give and take on those things. There's no point in my hiding it or trying to pretend to an objectivity I do not have. I 20 odd years ago I stopped reviewing his movies.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a friendship. And this new book is kind of it's less a sort of a biography or biographical piece about him. It's an attempt to kind of speak about our friendship, you know, what it's entailed, things we've done together, you know, impressions I've gathered of him over the years, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a very informal, fairly lengthy essay that begins the book. And then I did a piece, a short essay, you know, 500 to 800 words, on each of his movies for the rest of the book. So, you know, it's a fairly substantial piece of writing in that, you know, however many movies he's done, so there's probably 25 or 30,000 words on the films and another 12 or 15 on his life, or his life as I have perceived it being close to him. So, for me, it was kind of a fun book to write, in the sense that this is a good friend, somebody I spent a lot of time with, and I had never really stopped to think about what that friendship meant to me and what it might have meant, might mean to him. So I think it's a kind of a unique look at him, you know.
Well, I want to ask you a couple of things about Clint Eastwood.
Sure.
When he first began as a film maker, as well as a star,
uh-huh.
His films were not particularly taken seriously, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And also...
And neither he wasn't particularly taken seriously as an actor, either.
No, and I also think he had a sort of at least the image of being kind of a John Wayne-ish right-wing kind of guy. I mean, I recall at the Academy Awards when Marlon Brando had Sasheen Littlefeather
accept the award for him. And then Clint was the next presenter, and he said, well, maybe I should dedicate this next award to all the cowboys that got killed by and all the John Ford Westerns by all the Indians. But now we think of him as a liberal.
Clint is not, well...
I mean, his films now, you know, they're far more humanistic, and his films deal with things like in Gran Turismo.
I thought he got, you know, kind of, back in those early days, I thought he kind of got a bad rap on his, because nobody knew what his political views were, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of imagine, based on our, occasionally we touch on politics when we're having a drink or dinner or something, I think he pretty much votes Republican. He's kind of a fiscal conservative. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of guy who believes in balanced budgets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But his social views are you know, very liberalish. You know, he's in favor of abortion rights. He's in favor of gun control. He's not himself a guy who owns or shoots guns.
Even though he's a guy who owns and shoots them in every movie he's ever been in, right?
Well, sometimes, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm.
Yeah, but that doesn't... you know, we have in the film that I made, you know, White Hunter, Black Heart, which is about a guy who... John Huston kind of figure who wants to shoot an elephant.
Mm-hmm.
And Clint says, I don't understand guys like that. He said, I know they're out there, and I sort of understand what's pulling him. He said, but I don't shoot living creatures. I don't want to do that. I think they have a place on the planet and a right to live. And, you know, so he said it was kind of, you know, trying to get to understand somebody who doesn't have that view of, you know, animal life and animal rights and so forth. So I find him, you know, he's kind of... Stuff that makes him impatient is sort of, you know, he owns a hotel and restaurant up in Carmel. Very nice restaurant, very nice hotel, for that matter. I've stayed there several times. You know, there are all these rules they place on owners of public facilities, you know. You know, the steps have to be so high, and the this and that, and he gets cranky about that. You know, he's running a business that he thinks of as meant to serve the public and it to be as convenient as possible, but he doesn't want somebody coming in and telling him, no, the riser on the step is a half inch too big, you know, or something like that. That makes him kind of cranky. No, he's, to my mind, here's the thing, you know, when Clint came on the scene as an actor, you know, in the spaghetti westerns, particularly Dirty Harry shortly thereafter, you know, there was this, making the film, I'm looking at this face, this, you know, face, these are often twisted in anger and all of that. And I contrast that with the guy I know, you know, who's a low-keyed, kind of sort of gentle soul. I mean, he's not a wimp or anything, but he's not Dirty Harry, you know. I mean, and so you say, oh, I see. Dirty Harry was a real acting job for him.
Well, he does have a kind of a reputation of being one of those actors who doesn't appear to be acting, because I guess his technique is so hidden that...
Yeah, you have to remember, though, Clint's a very serious actor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he was a young actor, he studied for several years, you know, at with Stanislavski and teachers in Los Angeles. And he's very serious about that, and we've talked at great length about that, and... You know, he believes in his version of Stanislavski that, you know, what you're supposed to be portraying is a natural human being, right? The trick is to appear to be not acting, which is all Stanislavski was ever talking about. You know, we don't want you doing rhetorical acting. We don't want you doing broad strokes acting. We want you to look like a human being on stage. And he, Clint, of course, extends that, as most modern actors do, to the screen. You know, you are not supposed to be a grand, ranting figure. I think... excuse me. I think Clint is an extremely good movie actor, you know, as indeed John Wayne was. We were Morgan Freeman narrated this movie for me, and we were doing the narration last week, and we came to, you know, Million Dollar Baby, in which, you know, Morgan co-starred with Clint. He sort of stopped his narration. He said, because we were saying, you know, Clint won for Best Actor, and Hilary Swank won for Best Actress, and he won for Best Directing, and but Clint didn't win for Best Actor. And Morgan stopped, and he said, you know, he should have. He said, that's a great piece of work, and it was. I mean, it's a very, very nuanced performance as that boxing manager.
I think Gran Torino was also
fantastic. That he was just plain robbed.
They didn't nominate that for anything, did they?
No, and he's wonderful in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Clint is a mature actor. I think is just fabulous. You know.
Well, that's amazing thing about Clint Eastwood now. I mean, if you think about all of the great stars of the golden age of Hollywood, when they were Clint Eastwood's age, they were dead. and all of the great directors, when they were his age, they had either been dead or long retired. How long will Clint Eastwood go on?
Oh, I think... I don't know that he'll act a great deal, if at all, again, you know. He has said to me recently, he said, you know, the business of acting and directing in the same movie is... it's difficult. It's very, very... it just takes a lot out of him, you know, making that switch all the time from directing to acting. So I have a feeling that he will not, I think he'll go on directing for several more years, maybe many more years. You know, he's a very fit man, and great good health, and I would look to him to go on directing for at least another 5 or 6 years. I can't imagine him stopping. He loves doing it. He has a way of doing it that's very easygoing and, you know, is conservative, not only of his energy, but of the energy of his actors. So, I mean, he's lucky, I think, in his genetic structure and... you know, lucky in that. Here's the deal about Clint. You know, he's a man who likes to know how things work. You know, when he was a kid, you know, he had old cars, and he loved working on them and, you know, making them better than the heap he had bought for $100 or something. And he liked to know how that worked. He likes to know how music works. You know, and I'm almost astonished when he sits down and plays the piano, because he's a really expert pianist, you know. And that, again, is sort of like, well, how does music work? What's the structure of music? How does that, you know? And he's taken to composing, you know, in recent years for his films.
Right, yeah.
So, and he likes... I mean, he knows everything about how a movie works. You know, what lens will give you this effect and what lens will give you that effect. And all that stuff. He's a man who loves to learn how things work. And I think that's one of the things that keeps him young. You know, I mean, every script presents a problem that he wants to solve. That's very much part of his nature, you know. How does something work?
You know, looking back on his career, even back on his days as Rowdy Yates on Ride, he was a superb rider also. Does he still ride? He hasn't been in a Western in many, many years.
No, he won't be. He thought Unforgiven was all he ever could say about Westerns, you know, mm-hmm. about the Western genre. In fact, it was funny. I happened to read a Western book, this is about a decade ago, which I thought was quite good. And I said to him, you ought to read this. It's pretty good. You might enjoy, even though you say you don't want to do another Western, he said, you know, you might. I said, you might enjoy this. You might be something you would like to direct. Something, you know. I didn't hear from him. That happens a lot. We do recommend books and stuff to each other. And only, I think, within the last year, he said, you know that book you gave me? And I said, you mean, it was called The Last Ride. Ron Howard finally actually made that movie. Hmm. He said, you know, I almost did that. It's like 5-10 years later. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, it was a good story. I liked it. He said, I just finally decided I just didn't want to do another Western. That's all. But he said, I thought it was a very good story. And it was. It was a father-daughter story, which he was interested in. You know, about some of those emotions, you know, came out in Million Dollar Baby. And because the same thing, a kind of fractured relationship between an older man and his grown-up daughter. You know, I don't know where that's going, but just to say that even though he'd said he'd never do a Western, this he was a little bit tempted toward one more of them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to your book and your film about Clint Eastwood. The Eastwood Factor is the name of the film. What's the name of the book?
Yeah, the book is called Clint, A Retrospective. And it's, you know, it's advancing very well. It's, you know, we're going to have, I don't know, 75,000 copies in print in the United States to start with, so...
Well, I look forward...
That's good.
I look forward to seeing it, and maybe you might come back and talk some more.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Well, our guest has been Richard Schickel, and his most recent book out is called Betty Davis, Larger Than Life. His new book on Clint Eastwood coming any day now. Thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the sparkling Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne, and I want to thank our guest Richard Schickel for being with us this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.